Okay, good evening, everyone. It's Tuesday evening, July 31st. Welcome to Rabbi Feldman's weekly shiur. This week's shiur is sponsored by Aviva and David Horowitz to commemorate the yahrzeit of David's mother, Mrs. Gertrude Horowitz, Chaya Gittel Bas Yaakov Yosef. Welcome.
Good evening. A couple of apologies. First of all, I hope nobody's here adopted because of the announced topic to the I think I'm going to switch it, so I hope that's not a problem for anybody. Also, I don't know if we'll finish the topic tonight. I actually have to leave a few minutes early, so the chances are we won't. Probably be a two-parter. The second part will not be next week, because I'm not here next week, but it'll be, I guess, the week after, since it's the second part. And the topic is a next week topic, so since I'm pulling up this week, it's a Parshas Re'eh topic. I'd like to just address some general inyanim of tzedakah, which is a topic which is really dealt with perhaps most head-on in Parshas Re'eh. And it's a very difficult topic to pin down because on the one hand, it's something which is given largely to discretion, largely to people making their own decisions. And at the same time, the halacha very clearly addresses it extensively. It's a large section in Shulchan Aruch in Yerodeya. There's a lot to say about it. And yet it's still something that's always going to be dependent on decisions, and it's very hard to have any hard and fast rules. And in fact, the Vilna Gaon have a comment that the Pasuk says in Parshas Re'eh, Lo Sikbot Es Yadcha, that in the context of Tzedakah, you shouldn't close your fists, which seems to be a prohibition against refusing to give Tzedakah, to be tight-fisted, as the expression goes. And the Vilna Gaon had a comment that the reason the Torah says you shouldn't close your fists in the context of tzedakah is because when one closes his hand, so all the fingers look like they're the same size. And then when you open your hand, you see it's not true. All the fingers are different sizes. So he says that's the same thing when it comes to tzedakah. When it comes to tzedakah, if you just look in the book, so you think, okay, there are rules, I can follow this policy, I can follow that policy, and it's all very well done. And then when it comes to real life, so you see that there's so many variables, it's very difficult to follow a predetermined set of rules. So in that sense, we thought it was represented by this idea of, well, sikpot sasyatka, you shouldn't close your fist, you shouldn't get the impression that the rules are going to be 100% applicable, because real life is so much more complicated, so you have to be aware of that going in. So on the one hand, there is this variable to every situation. A, it's all the situations are variable. And B, it's that you do have a right to a certain level of discretion. You have a right to a certain degree of making your own decisions as to how you're going to give your tzedakah. And yet, at the same time, the halacha has a lot to say about it. And the idea should be that when one does use the discretion in how he's going to give his tzedakah, that it's not on a whim, it's not just you're deciding whatever comes into your head, but that the discretion should be something that's informed by halachic values. And that it's something that is based on exposure to some of the discussions and some of the sources that we have on this topic. So one of the many issues that's discussed in this context is the question of, should you diversify? You know, should you give all your stuff to many different places, the same way they recommend when you're investing? So they say you shouldn't put it all in one place, who knows what's going to happen. So too, stock is the greatest investment there is. And so you shouldn't invest it all in one place, you should spread it out. Or do you say, if I'm going to do that, then I'm going to dilute the impact. It's not going to have the same effect. If I'm going to give only a little bit to everybody, I can have a much bigger effect, can have a much bigger impact on the world if I'm going to concentrate it. So what exactly do you do about that? So this was a little bit of a debate among Rishonim, among the Poskim, but perhaps the dominant voice on this issue is a statement of the Rambam. And the Rambam has a comment in his Perush HaMishnayos to Perkei Avos, where the Mishnah has a statement, Hakol Lefi Rov HaMa'aseh. So how exactly do you translate that phrase? And everything is evaluated based on the Rov of the actions. The Rambam understands this word Rov to mean a multitude rather than magnitude. It's something happening many times rather than something happening with great impact. So in that context, the Rambam says the person has a certain sum of money which he could either divide up into many small gifts or he can give all in one shot. He would recommend that this is what the Mishnah is telling us, that things are dependent on the multitude of the action. You should rather give many acts of tzedakah rather than give it all into one shot. So that comment, basically, if we just look at the conclusions, that's what he's saying, right? Diversify. But if we come from the perspective of why, so then we see a couple of different components here. That I could say that on the one hand, this is better for the world. That's what the Rambam is basically saying, that the world is better off if I take care of more people, even if I don't do it to such a great degree. And the world is lopsided if all the stuff that goes into one place. Or I could say that he's not necessarily talking about the impact on the world. He's talking about the impact on you. That tzedakah has an impact on the soul, that it makes a charitable personality. And this is really what his lashon sounds like. His language basically sounds like that's what he's talking about. That if a person gives many times, every time he gives, he's conquering his impulse to hold back. He's increasing his sense of generosity. And every time he does that, so he's contributing to his charitable personality. So that's a valuable thing. So if he's going to have $100 to give, then he could give it give $1 100 times. So that's 100 acts of generosity. That's going to have a much bigger impact on his soul than biting the bullet once and parting with $100 in one shot. And alternatively, you could say the way we said before, that it's just about trying to make sure the world in general is taken care of, and it's about a certain economic theory to say that it's better off that everybody should get a little bit than to have a very lopsided contribution. So who cares why it is? What difference does it make? So this is one of the many areas we could discuss where it makes a difference depending on whether it's your money or not. And this is a conversation we could have really in two tracks, that we could talk about somebody donating his own money, and we could talk about also somebody who's in charge of a public fund, which could mean, for example, let's say a rabbinic discretionary fund where the rabbi has the say over where the money goes, but it's not his money. He's taking the money of others and he's deciding how it should be given out. Or there are many other models. Anybody who is in charge of some type of a public charity, or a gabbai tzedakah in general who is dealing with the money of others, as we'll see, there could be very different rules. So there could be cases, and there could be a number of cases that we could talk about, where you might come to one decision if it's your private money, where you're latitude of discretion is a little bit more, and you might come to another decision, you might have to come to another decision if you're dealing with somebody else's money. If you're entrusted with giving out a fund that's not from your pocket, there may be a very different set of rules. So this question of understanding why the Rambam says what he says, and understanding that there are those who disagree with the Rambam, the Maharal of Prague probably disagree with the Rambam, a few others probably disagree with the Rambam, but the Rambam's voice is pretty dominant on this. He's the one probably most often quoted on this subject. Even if we agree with his pro-diversification conclusion, so we want to know why it is, because we want to know how it would affect this question. Because if it's about my spiritual growth, it's about my development, that the more I give tzedakah, the better off I will be ultimately, so then I don't have a right to make decisions from that perspective if it's not my money. And that if I'm the one in charge of a fund that was donated to by others, so then presumably I can only use one of two perspectives. Either what's best for the cause, you know, what I think will benefit the world the best, or, and this is a more complicated area which we're not really even getting into, now I may have a right to, in some limited circumstances, to evaluate what the donors would have liked. So let's say, for example, if I'm a rabbinic discretionary fund, so I have all the money came from members of the shul, and I know the shul is very much in favor of a certain cause. So then I could perhaps factor that in saying that I'm going to give the money towards this cause because I can evaluate that the donors like that cause. And if I give it to a cause which I know they're all against, you know, then one can make a case that that's really not right. But that's a more complicated freshman, so let's leave that out of the story for now. That comes up in some other cases, just a topic that we pretty definitely won't get to tonight. But one of the very, very complicated areas of Hilchos Tzedakah, there's a whole response literature on, many, many tshuvas written about this topic, is the concept of shinui mitzedakah l'tzedakah. It's a very, very complicated topic. The question of, you have money that was donated for one tzedakah, and you, for whatever reason, want to give it to another tzedakah. So it's very tricky situation that when people gave money with the intent that it should go to one tzedakah, so you have two complicated factors. On the one hand, you have the idea that that tzedakah kind of was zocher to the money, kind of acquired the money through that commitment, so you're a little bit taking, if you were to switch it to a different stucco, so you're basically stealing from that charity that has already, so to speak, laid a claim to it. And also, the donors gave it under the presumption that it was going for that cause, and to divert it to a different cause is also questionable from their perspective. So the idea of shinui mitzdaka l'tzedaka is a very, very complicated issue. This Gemara Erchin touches upon it a little bit, but it's much more discussed in the later sources. And the problem is sometimes you have to. Sometimes you have a situation where circumstances change, and you can't always, ideally, in an ideal world, you can call up the donors and say, listen, you gave me this money for this, but the circumstances have changed. Now what do you want me to do? So if you could ask the person what you want to do, so that helps. But even that's not so simple, because, first of all, then their question of when they've given something for tzedakah and when, how they could change that becomes complicated. And also, maybe you don't want to do that. Maybe you feel that if the halacha allows you to use this for a different tzedakah, you don't want to give the person the opportunity to take it back and diminish tzedakah funds. It's all very complicated. So basically, the whole issue of shinui mitzdaka l'tzedakah is a highly complex one. But one of the factors that come to play, so let's say you have a circumstance where something changes. A circumstance where you collected money for somebody to have an operation or something like that, and the person gets better or the operation is paid for, whatever the cause that you collected for isn't there anymore. So then what happens? So then, again, ideally you could consult with the people, but if you can't, so you have this money that's donated and now you have to do something with it, so there the post can talk about finding something that's as similar as possible. You know, finding something that's comparable to the cause, and part of the element is that you're trying to evaluate what the people would want, the people who gave this money, so what would they have in mind if they were willing to give to cause A, and cause A doesn't exist anymore, so you find something as similar as possible to cause A, and the presumption that they would be just as moved to give to that, and that you're not really deviating from their wishes. Hi.
It seems that not only could the cause no longer be there, but the people might no longer be living.
Right. So there are many circumstances in which the cause may no longer exist. Right. The need may change, or any circumstance can come up where, if you say the donors may no longer be living. Right. The donors may no longer be living. Right. The donors may no longer be living, but also more common scenarios, you can't identify the donors. You took up an appeal for something, you raised $100,000, and now I can't differentiate the $100,000 who can't live. So that's a more common scenario. Like it's not feasible to consult other people. So that's an issue that comes up, a highly complex topic. And part of it is, one of the factors that comes into play is you try to calculate a little bit what's the closest available cause. So that's something, again, we're not going to get into so much tonight, but that sometimes could come into play when you're administering a public fund, that you sometimes maybe you're trying to figure out what the donors would want. But for the most part, presumably, you'd have to act based on some objective standard as what's best for the cause. So if you're going to say that the pro-diversification theory that the Rambam has is not necessarily motivated by your spiritual development, but it's motivated by the fact that economically speaking, the world is better off this way, so then that's a legitimate factor to bring into the equation. But if it's just about your phone case, so you don't have the right to get some of the donations of other people, you don't have the right to decide, okay, I'll use their money for my spiritual high, it's not really your right. It's also a question how much it helps if it's not really your money anyway, you're not moving your own generosity. But so what exactly is the reason is an important factor to figure out as far as that's concerned. So if the Rambam, his language does sound like he really is talking about your personal growth, but the Bach takes a similar position of pro-diversification, but he's clearly talking about something else. He's clearly talking about the cause. The Bach writes, one of the places you could look, and if you want to know about Hilchos Tzedakah, so again, in Shulchan Aruch there is a very large section, a very significant section of Hilchos Tzedakah in the Yerideya, but it also comes up in context of various Yom Tovim. We know Yom Tovim have certain tzedakahs associated with them, among them very prominently Purim. Purim has the chiyuv of Matanis Levyonim. So in the laws of Matanis Levyonim, with the gifts that we give out on Purim, so the Bach writes on the side of the page of the Torah that to him it seems very obvious, it's very pashut, that if you have an opportunity to give $100 in one shot, or whatever it is, say a dollar 100 times, it's clear that the latter is preferable to him, and the way he finishes a sentence is because with that you have sustained 100 poor people. So he's clearly focused on the fact that the world, in his assessment, is going to be better off by doing that, and therefore he's advocating that position. So that would be something that would equally apply whether you are a private donor or whether you're a donor of public funds. Obviously, in the example of 100 to 1 or however you want to take it, we have to be talking at points where you're not diluting things to the point where it's not significant at all. So without getting into real numbers, the point is that let's assume that we're talking about either one concentrated gift or we're talking about less concentrated but something that's still at least of some value to people who we're dealing with. So, hi.
Is that more
So there is a Gemara, good segue question. Well, the Rambam sounds like a more hashkafic concept. He's talking about how do you enhance your own spirituality, what's better for your soul. It's better for your soul to do this. So that's really more of a hashkafic concept. You know, and still, it's also more of an etza. Right? So the truth is, once you bring up the question, so really he's coming really outside of the laws of tzedakah. He's talking about the laws of midos. Right? So if you're midos, you'll be affected better this way. The Bach's perspective is more of a halachic svar because he's assuming that you have a certain responsibility to be judicious in how you spend this money. So therefore, we have to factor in that, okay, the world will be better off this way. So that's a better way to do it. So if you have a makor, there is a Gemara Maseches Erevin, where the Gemara talks in the context of Matnas Kahuna, the gifts that you have to give to the Kohanim, the different parts of the animal, the produce. So the Gemara says that whoever gives all his matanos to one Kohen is Marivis Olam. Whoever gives, and keep in mind the system there is that you have the Yisraelim basically making a living and they're sustaining the Kohanim and the Levim. So if they were to choose to give all the gifts to one Kohen, so that's going to bring famine into the world. In other words, it's just not a efficient way to distribute the resources of the world. If everybody's going to give all their gifts in one place, or if even one person is going to focus all of matanas in one place, so then the world's not going to really be taken care of, and that's not an efficient way to do things. The Maharsham discusses this in his Chuvas, and he understands that in general this is talking about somebody who does it his whole life. And his whole life he gives all of his tzedakah to one place, and he never worries about anybody else. So that's really where the criticism of the Gemara comes from. While if he, let's say he has a plan every month, he calculates what he's going to do with his money that month, so in January he decides to give all his money to one person, so that post can generally assume there's nothing wrong with that, to decide, okay, this month I'm going to focus on this goal, next month I'm going to focus on something else, but that the criticism is more directed at somebody who would say his entire life he's not going to worry about anything except one cause, so then that's not going to be so good for the world. Again, so basically this question of are we pro-diversifying or are we pro-concentration, so that itself is a little bit of a question. But even if we assume that diversification is the way to go, which seems to be backed by the Rambam and the Bach, it could be the Rambam and the Bach are focusing on two different elements, what it does for you and what it does for others, and that could be important in talking about the distinction between private money and public money. Another area in which you have to take into concern this distinction, and this is something that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky writes, it's considered a sefer of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's Ha'aris on the Shulchan Aruch, so the Emes Yaakov you have on Chumash, and you have on other spots, they have a sefer on the Shulchan Aruch also from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. So there he writes that again, if somebody is collecting from public funds, so he has other responsibilities. So one of the responsibilities that he has is he's got to make sure that he's giving out the tzedakah in a way that's going to encourage people to continue giving. So he's also got to worry about how it looks. So if you're an individual and you decide to give all your money to one person, to one cause, your whole life, that's one issue. I know that always so terrible. If you're a public stucker, which has to worry to make sure the donations keep coming, and you're going to give it all to one place, so there could be people who are going to say, I'm not happy with that. I'm not impressed with how this fund is working, and I don't want to contribute any more money to that. And therefore, that's also, it's not an easy job being a Gabbai Tzedakah, and that's also part of what they worry about. You know, the Gemara says, you should be happy you're not a Gabbai Tzedakah. If you're not, it's not such an easy thing. You have to worry that people are going to say, I'm not interested in donating to this fund anymore. So you're back to rights, that if you're dealing with public money, that's an additional cheshbon to keep in mind when you decide whether you're going to concentrate or you're going to diversify. So that's one area very much to keep in mind. Okay, so let's decide, all right, so whatever it is, I will diversify somewhat. But then the question is, okay, so how do I decide how I'm going to diversify. So there are a lot of principles that come into mind here, a lot of aspects that come into the discussion, different categories, different individuals, different types of causes, and also how exactly do you proportionalize. So before we get into what comes before what, you're probably the most famous phrase in this context is Aniya Yerecha Kodman, that the people from your town have first priority, even that's within the context of a couple of other things. But before we get to that, the whole idea of Kodman, what does that mean? So the idea of something coming first, so there was a Machlokas HaPoskim about this as well, but the Chassam Sofer and others, Chassam Sofer has a number of very important shuvas about this, very influential, and the Chassam Sofer assumes as a basic principle that when we talk about Kodman, we don't mean that, so if I have a certain amount of staka, and we decide that priorities 1, 2, 3, and 4, so you give all your money to priority 1, and then if priority 1 is totally taken care of, then you move on to priority 2. And then if you totally take care of priority 2, then you can move on to priority 3. So you assume that that's not what it means, but that it's a question of proportionalization. That, you know, and then the numbers again get tricky. They're folks going to talk about numbers, and it's a little bit of a matter of judgment. But the assumption is, okay, you'll give the bulk of your staka to priority 1. And then what's left, you'll give the bulk to priority 2. And then what's left, you'll give the bulk to priority 3, etc., etc. But naturally, you're going to give everything to the first one until it's full, because likelihood is that no cause is ever going to get full. And then, again, we get into the issue of diversification. So that very much comes out of that issue. So before we get into any specific priorities, so in general, there is a very complicated question, or at least a very weighty question as far as the obligation of tzedakah, and as far as how it affects us practically, that again, looking to Parshas Re'eh, so the Sukkim tell us basically two prohibitions that are connected with tzedakah. That's how Tosfos and Maseches Ksuvos points out, that you should understand that there are two lavin, two prohibitions that are connected with tzedakah. When we mentioned the Losikpo says Yarkov Losamit says Lavak, you shouldn't close your hand and you shouldn't harden your heart. That apparently if somebody asks you for tzedakah and you're not gonna give, so then that's criticized with a don't, or really two don'ts. Don't close your hand, don't harden your heart. So that's very scary. So how the post can talk about that. So what exactly does that mean? This happens all the time. You know, people ask you for money and you're gonna say no. So it's the same thing as eating treats. It's a lot in the Torah. It's, you know, so basically, everybody who gets asked, depending on where you live or where you work or where you walk past, you could be asked 15, 20 times a day. If you're going to say no to any one of them, it's the same thing as wearing shatnez. It's twice. It's two lot in the Torah. It's a very difficult situation. So the machlokas about this, first of all, the machlokas the Rambam and the Rashba, whether it's bad enough if you just know about it, or do you have to actually be asked? You have to actually be approached. So, okay, let's assume that we pass and you have to actually be approached. It doesn't help so much because you get approached enough times. So you'll get approached by enough people in the course of the day, probably, where, again, you're not going to be able to take care of them all. So where exactly do these prohibitions kick in? Where exactly do they come into place? So part of it has to do, we have a obligation of De Machzero, which also again comes from the Torah and Parshas Re'eh. And there, the basic intent of the Pasuk, the way the Gemara in Ksubas understands it, is that if you have somebody who has suffered a loss, and a monetary loss, and they had a certain lifestyle beforehand, so the obligation of Tzedakah is to bring them back, at least temporarily, and that's some discussion as well, to the lifestyle they were accustomed to. And the Gemara has some very extreme examples of what that could mean. Somebody used to a very luxurious lifestyle who all of a sudden falls out of it, so apparently there's an obligation to bring him back up to snuff. So how exactly do you deal with that? So that's, again, already a crushing burden for anybody to take care of. And to what extent are you fully responsible by yourself for Dei Machzero? So here the Rama writes, and there are those who disagree with him, the Rama writes, De Machzero was never meant to be an individual chiyuv, it was meant more to be a communal chiyuv. That the tzibur should worry about the individual, and that the tzibur should try to fulfill his need, not that it's an obligation on any one individual. And there are those who disagree with the Rama, but as Rav Vosner points out in his Shuvah, that even if there is a question in halacha whether Rama is right, the reality passes like Rama. It's simply impossible. No one knows the needs are so great. Everybody has so many aniyim. People have so many needs that the idea that anyone's going to be able to really fulfill this is too much to imagine. So we have to assume that it's rather a communal need. And therefore, basically, what's its purpose? Its purpose is not so much to show what you have to do in order to be Yotze, so to speak. You know, probably the mindset that you have is the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, so la'olacham v'lacha ligmora v'lo'ata ben chorol nibatol mena, that you have to worry about it, but you're never going to be free of it. You're never going to fully accomplish it. But more to establish what's legitimate staka. That if something is, if a person has a lifestyle that he fell from, at least temporarily, at least while he's being transitioned into a different set point, so then there is an emotional need of staka, there is a suffering that's going on, and the need to take care of that is something that we recognize, something that we recognize as legitimate staka. Which doesn't mean, again, when you're comparing, so if you have somebody who used to have a very fancy car, now he can't afford a fancy car anymore. So in theory, the machzor might mean that that's a real need. If you have somebody next door to him who's starving, you know, so it doesn't mean that because of Dei Machzor I'm going to worry more about this guy's fancy car than the guy who's starving. It's still, again, we have limited resources and you're still deciding how to allocate these resources. But again, the question would be, let's say you have infinite resources, so still stuck is still going to go for stuck. If you have infinite resources, you're not going to spend stuck on luxuries. But this person's need to get back to the emotional state of where he was, that's something that we recognize. So in theory, you have this idea of Dei Machzor, and that's going to be apparently an obligation on the tzibur. So what if a person doesn't live in the tzibur? If a person is traveling from place to place and he's collecting money, so here the post can generally assume, on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, that this is not, that's not a responsibility of Dei Machzor. If somebody shows up from out of town and says, listen, I have this tremendous need, so it's not that town's responsibility to take care of them, it's the town's responsibility to take care of the people in the town. When a person is himself diversifying, he's himself collecting among many different places, so then there's a normal chiyuv to respond to him, but the chiyuv is not the same. It's a chiyuv, the post can talk about money for two meals, something like that, but not something that's on this same level. So, Dei Machzor, there are some posts who understand that the prohibitions of sikpos, losamit, these psukim are mentioned in the context of Dei Machzor, and they're two halves of the equation. So that if you have a responsibility of Dei Machzor, meaning that the community or that he's from your community, is not somebody who's traveling from place to place, so then in theory we can start talking about these prohibitions. But if it's somebody who happens to be stopping off in every town, so then presumably these prohibitions may, according to this theory, not apply. And perhaps the most solid theory that you find this among the Rishonim, as far as saving us from two prohibitions every time you say no, is that there are a number of Rishonim who understand that it doesn't mean that any time you say no, you're in violation of the prohibition of lo sikpos lo samit. It means that if that's the motivation, if you decide that you're a nasty person, so you decide that you're not interested in anybody suffering, so you harden your heart and you close your fist and say, I'm not giving tzedaka, I'm not interested in people's issues, so then that's a violation of the Isser, the Torah, of these two Isser. But if you have a reason, and perhaps the reason is going to be that either you don't trust the person, which often is the case, you don't know that it's a legitimate cause, and the Gemara also has this expression, Bo Nachzik Tov L'Ramayim, we should thank the liars, we're happy they exist, because they save us from being in trouble. But if everybody were telling the truth all the time, so then we have a much higher standard of responsibility as far as responding. But since we know that not everybody's telling the truth, and even the people who are telling the truth, so we don't know that they're telling the truth, because there are so many people who don't tell the truth, so because of that, so therefore we're justified in being a little hesitant sometimes. So that's going to be our defense when I come before Shemayim and Kodesh Baruch Hu is wanting to give stock. They say, well, because there are so many people out there who aren't telling the truth, that I had to be a little more hesitant. So that's going to be your defense. But Shemayim says we should be grateful to these people for complicating the picture a little bit, because otherwise we'd really be in trouble. So that's one issue that maybe you don't trust. And that's not a common excuse. That's a real issue. It's also the burden of of Sukkah is very significant here, especially if you're a Gabbai Sukkah with other people's funds. So you have to be very careful that who you're giving to is a legitimate Sukkah. Otherwise, you can't, I'll be too trusting, and therefore I'll be sacrificing the Sukkah money of people who felt that they were doing a mitzvah, and in the end you're giving it for a non-charitable cause. That's a very serious issue, and it's also an issue if it's your own money, the money you think you're giving for Sukkah, but it's certainly an issue of very serious magnitude if you're working on behalf of the tzibur. That becomes a very serious issue. Hi.
You have a certain amount of money you're supposed to give for tzedakah, for your obligation of tzedakah.
Mm-hmm.
How does it work? Does it have to go to individuals or to an organization? How does the organization
depends if you're depends if you're the government or if you're the government wants to give to organizations, because that's what they recognize as tax exempt. When it comes to halacha, it's a complicated issue, because on the one hand, you know, sometimes people feel better giving to an individual directly because it goes straight. There's no management costs, there's no administration, there's no budget. So you're giving 100% of the money is going to this cause. But on the other hand, you run a lot of risks because the organizations are hopefully more responsible and hopefully more able to look into things. And the reason people deal with organizations, the reason the government deals with organizations, is because the presumption is that they have looked into things and they know what they're doing.
Some organizations may not give 100% to the
need. All organizations don't give 100%. No organization can, because every organization has costs. So.
Federation.
Oh, they would not be by name at all.
Right.
So that's also possible.
Exactly.
Right, so that we'll get to. We probably won't get to tonight, and we'll get to maybe in the future about different types of causes. But even let's say that's a different issue. You may also, as an individual, decide not to give only to poverty. You might decide to give to other mitzvot. Very possibly, most likely. But that's a separate issue. But the question is, whatever the cause you decide is you're giving to an organization, then by definition, 100% is not going to go to the cause. Although it is going to the cause. It's going to the cause because the cause is helped by the organization existing, and the organization therefore needs to be there, needs to operate, needs to have employees in order to function. So you are giving to the cause, but you're not giving directly to the Ani. So some people prefer to give directly to the Ani, but then you have these ones donated to an organization, to another organization, an organization that collects all the organizations in one place, and I sent a donation through that organization to a second one, and I got a letter from the organization saying thank you very much for your donation, but you should just know if you gave it directly to us it would have gotten even better, would have gotten more of it, so thank you for donating to that guy, but next time here's our address. Yeah, right. Next time go direct. So every time you have the middleman it takes away a little bit, but you need that, so it's all part of the equation. Hi.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably now, the question is how far do you want to go with the equation? Now once you link these lavin to their machzoros, then you can make the case that if there's a genuine fear of their machzor again, you kind of set up a story that it's a pretty rare situation that's the case. So then presumably, if you're not going all the way, then there is some lack. But once we say that that's generally not going to be the case, then presumably you have the right to scale it down. So we got the same question could be, if I'm a very wealthy person and I'm just giving out very token amounts, so then the fact that I'm giving something doesn't take away the fact that there is imut talev and a closing of the fist involved. It just changes it, but it doesn't take that away. So the same way I could not give and have good motivations, I can give and not have enough good motivations. I can give such a small amount that I am still expressing imut talev, and presumably you still have a problem from that perspective. But the fact that you can have these excuses helps us to understand. We'll clarify that point again in a second.
Limit?
I'm sorry, I didn't know if you were there.
Limit?
Mm-hmm.
I said, what
also, what is the limit? So let's talk about that in a second. I mean, I'm going to have to end a little bit early, so we'll have to continue a lot of these habits.
Is there a presumption that tzedakah should be selfless? In other words, there should be no return to the individual?
Not necessarily. It depends what you mean by return.
What I'm thinking of in particular is if one gives to a particular person or a particular charity, then there's the satisfaction of having done something for someone. on the other hand, if you give it to, if you spread it out, as the Rambam says, then there will be no particular satisfaction except that you've done your, you complied with the luck.
I think there is satisfaction in that also, you know, the fact that you've contributed to the world in a broader sense without being in a sense that's more wide and deep, but that's also a satisfying thing, plus you have the value that you're strengthening your charitable instincts. So I think in both cases you're benefiting yourself. And the point about benefit in general is an interesting question which we probably won't get to tonight, but you know, the question of plaques and the like and other types of honoring of people for its practice, that you find actually a lot of support for, the famous Shuvah Sarasba. You know, just again, nothing we'll get to tonight, but just give you a taste of. The Rashba has a famous statement which a lot of latest forum quote, especially in the page where they thank their donors, they quote this Shuvah Sarasba, that Rashba has a sense, mitzvah lefarsem osa mitzvah, and it's something you have to do to publicize people who do mitzvahs. You have to call attention to people who have contributed, and the proof they bring is the statement in a medrash that goes to Reuven. You know, that Reuven, the brother of Yosef, so he saved Yosef's life. Right? The brothers were going to kill him, and he said, don't kill him, just throw him in a pit, and that'll be good. So the statement the medrash has, that if Reuven only knew that he was going to be written in the Torah and that we'd be reading about this so many generations later about what he did, so he wouldn't have just said put him in the pit, he would have lifted him on his shoulders and he would have marched him home, he would have saved his life if he had known that all these generations later for all eternity we'd be reading about him, he would have gone even further. So based on that measure, so the Rashba and others quote this idea that people are willing to do good things, but if they know that people are going to know about it and they know that it's going to be recorded and archived, so then they'll go even further. So therefore, in the interest of tzedakah, in the interest of motivating others and motivating them, you know, some people worry about motivating others. You know, sometimes you see there's a drive in the yeshiva, and as people sign up to give to donate to a certain fund, and you see that the column, each column, one of the rebbeim's name is on top. That he, you know, so he's trying to inspire other people that they should know that he did it too, and therefore you know, they should also donate. But that's one type of game, but also the people who are giving themselves. They know that their name is going to be up there, so they're willing to donate even more. So there's a lot of support for that in the sources. So even if that type of selfless we don't find. But as far as a limit, and again, unfortunately, I'm limited, so I'll just very quickly start this topic, and we'll continue this in 2 weeks. There's a lot more to say about this. But one thing that's important to keep in mind, there is a statement that Gemara has in the Sefer Ksuvos, which has been extrapolated to mitzvos in general, but the Gemara is talking about tzedakah. The Gemara says that, and it has a funny language, and then the first half of the sentence the Gemara doesn't say, is that we have a custom of ma'aser ksavim, this idea of giving a tenth of your money. It's a custom that's prevalent among non-Jews also. You know, Christians talk about tithing, about giving a tenth of their money to the church. So this idea is based, loosely or not, on Yaakov. Yaakov, after he got his dream, so Kadosh Baruch Hu says, I'll always be with you. And Yaakov says, Sarah Asren, I'll give you a tenth of whatever I have. So there are those who say, okay, that shows you that the mitzvah in HaTorah is to give a tenth. And the more common possibility is that it's a minig, is that this is not really actual halacha, but this is a custom which is supported by this idea of giving 10%. And Oda Bizuta has a tshuva in one place where he's asked to talk about the laws regulating this idea of ma'aser ksavim, of giving a tenth. He says he's very uncomfortable writing a halacha tshuva about this because the fact is it's not a real halacha. There aren't gemaras about it really. It's not something that really is established as law. It's more of a custom that's developed, and he doesn't feel he can talk about it in a direct halachic sense. But in any event, so the second half of that sentence, with the first half not in the gemara, but the gemara says in Ksuvos, so hamavazve is a very strange word. It sounds like it means somebody who's wasting money, somebody who's squandering money. Hamavazve is al yuvazve yosem echomesh. You shouldn't, so to speak, release. You shouldn't squander. It's a strange language. You shouldn't spend more than a fifth. So a tenth is recommended as a minimum, but it's also a maximum. You shouldn't give more than a fifth of your money because maybe if you're going to do that, so you yourself are going to become poor, and that's not going to help the world. If you yourself end up on the rolls of tzedakah, so then that's not going to help anything. And there are those who understand the Dvar Yeshua of Yeshua Menachem Ehrenberg from Tel Aviv, the Shuv in which he understands the pasuk Efes Ki Lo Yevecha Evyon, which we read to mean that there will always be poor people, but so So the negative language in that pasuk, so he reads that to me as a prohibition. You're not supposed to let yourself become poor. That if you have the ability to conserve your estates, that you'll be able to continue giving stock and you'll be able to continue sustaining at least yourself. So then you have to worry about that. You don't have the right to say, I'll throw myself on the community. I'll just give away all my money and then everyone else will have to support me. He actually understands that as a prohibition. The Gemara, this statement of the Gemara sounds like it was a rabbinic enactment. The Gemara has this language, Ba'usha Hiskinu, that in the city of Usha they made certain enactments, and one of the enactments was you shouldn't spend more than a fifth of your money on tzedakah. So apparently this is the range. It shouldn't really be less than a tenth, at least by force of custom, and it shouldn't be more than a fifth, either by force maybe of biblical law like the Devar Yeshua, more likely of rabbinic enactment. It's not right to spend more than a fifth because of the risks to your own financial well-being, and then the people are going to have to worry about you. Now, of course, there are exceptions to that. And you have somebody, as the Chavetz Chaim talks about in the Sefer HaNechesed, you have somebody who's phenomenally wealthy, so then he could give away 90% of his income and still be 10 times richer than everybody else, so then we don't say he's limited to 20%. It's talking to an average person. The assumption is that people who are making an average income, whatever it is, they can afford to give a certain amount, but once they reach a certain threshold, whatever the average income is, once they reach a certain threshold, then they're really risking their own financial stability, and that's not right. Hi. So that gets complicated also. So the way they generally talk about that, both as far as the tenth and a fifth, is that, you know, when you first, and we'll end at this point because we're going to skip to Minnesota, we'll continue this topic going in 2 weeks. So that first, when you first decide to start getting involved in stock, so then you take the money that you have and you give a tenth of that or a fifth of that, and then after that, from all of your profits. Now, what does profit mean? So presumably it means what you have left over after taxes. This is a very complicated discussion, but especially when we're talking about income tax with the post and rights, so then that's basically money that you don't ever get. You know, the assumption is that it's also, it would be one thing if there was a set amount of tax for everybody, everybody was giving $100, everybody was giving $1,000, so then you could say, okay, this is an expense. But if the level of money you have to pay is calibrated to how much you make, so then you really have a strong case to say that you're not ever getting this money. This money is all, by definition, being taken off from the top. So the general assumption is presumably it means after what you have left after taxes. But again, as far as the Meister Kesafim issue, as far as they'll say talking about an affirmative obligation, I'm also like to note the hesitant to talk about it in too absolute a term, because it is a matter of custom where there are varying interpretations. But as far as the maximum, so presumably whatever you would talk about the minimum, it's the same system as talking about the maximum, that you don't want to be left with too big a hit, because then you're going to be in trouble. And the Ramah extends this to mitzvos. And the Gemara talks about it in the context of tzedakah, and the Ramah assumes this is not just talking about tzedakah, it's talking about all religious obligations. So if you can't afford tefillin, you can't afford a lulav and esrog, you can't afford something like that, so then you have a limit. If it costs more than 20%, you're basically off the hook, and you're assumed that you're not obligated to spend half your money on tefillin, or all your money on an esrog, whatever it is, you're not obligated to do that, unless it's a prohibition. If it's a prohibition, so then the Ramah says, prohibitions you have to worry about much more. You have to be ready to give up all your money not to violate a prohibition. And the truth is the Vilna Gaon disagreed with that as well. The Vilna Gaon thought that this was across the board. Positives and negatives, it's only a fifth of your money, and that you don't have to come to that conclusion. But that's a separate discussion. So let's stop here for tonight. And forgive me for running out now, but God willing, in 2 weeks we'll talk a little bit more about some of the issues of stock. And in between we'll reply to today, and you'll see it all, in fact. Okay, have a wonderful 2 weeks.